Hello everyone, we're back for season 2 of the Weird Podcast. If you're not tuning in for the first time, you may be finding it strange. After all, this used to be in Portuguese. Well, my friends, what can I say? The winds have spoken and the Weird Podcast is now officially in English. Today, for the beginning of season 2, I'll bring you an interview that I've been safekeeping for quite some time. My apologies for that. She is one of my favorite authors, Westria Avalon. Wooden's Children and Hallowed Isle are some of her, of the series of novels that she wrote. But personally, I prefer Taking Up the Runes, Essential Zatru, Transportation, or the most recent, Odin. She's also the founder or leader in Ethan or Neo-Pagan societies, and out of sheer curiosity, her name means Peace-Bringing Warrior. I'm talking, you've probably read it by now in the title of this episode, about the one and only Diana Paxson. What follows is a phone conversation we had a couple of months ago. Yes, I know it's long, but this one I simply cannot edit. We talk about politics, Umbanda, possession work, amongst many other subjects, so please stay tuned. The conversation is up next, but first, let me tell you something important. As you all know, the Weird Podcast is an indie project I began at home. So if you want to show me your love for this podcast, please shop for t-shirts or sweatshirts at this amazing clothing shop called weird.tmeal.com. It's wyrd.tmeal.com. And check out my online courses at gumroad.com/WYRD, so gumroad.com/weird, and also add your favorite podcast on facebook.com/weirdpodcast or Instagram at instagram.com/podcast.weird. And I'm not gonna make you waste any more time. Here it is, our interview. Thank you very much for joining me on the Weird Podcast. It's really a big pleasure and something that I've been longing to do for quite some time. So let's start with, well, we always start the podcast with a story. Usually either I or the guest tells a story. In this case, I'm just going to ask you, what's your favorite story from the lore, from the Norse lore?
Well, I guess maybe I could say that the Siegfried story, because it's certainly the one that I spent the most time working with when I wrote the Wodan's Children trilogy.
Mm-hmm. And what's so special about it?
One of the things that attracted me, besides really liking Wagner's operas, was that at the time when historically, if it happened, it would have happened, which would be during the migrations period, Europe was in a time of transformation. The Germanic tribes were moving in, and when they finally reached the ends of their migrations and settled down, they became the source of the nations of modern Europe. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a map of the migrations of those period, it reminds me of the maps we're seeing now of migrations into Europe and the reactions of the Romanized people who were living there were very much like the reactions of many people in Europe today to the migration that's going on now. I was also, as an American, where we are a nation of immigrants, very interested in the question of when you move into a new land, how do you acculturate? How do you find out when to plant and when to plow and where the sacred places are and how to settle in and live there.
And the appropriation that that the newcomer does for the old religions and the old customs, right? The you know the transposition and the mixture of beliefs.
Yes, although for the most part, the religious conversion went from the native people, the preceding people of Europe, to the invaders. Although certainly things changed somewhat. If you there's a book called the Heliand, which is a I think 9th century old High German version of the Christian Gospels, only somehow it has shifted in focus quite a lot. So for instance, they keep talking about Jesus and his war band, and Jesus on the cross sounds an awful lot like Odin on the world tree.
Yeah, so. It does. It actually does. And the even the story of Baldur, right? Even the story of Baldur's resurrection sounds quite similar to some of those stages.
Yeah, there's a scholar, Gerald Murphy, I think it's Gerald. He's a Jesuit priest teaching at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And he translated the Heliand into English. And he also has done a very interesting book on Scandinavian churches and seeing all of the heathen imagery that got incorporated into them.
We're talking about immigration, and one of the things that nowadays strikes the heathen community very much is that the politics involved. I guess we have always had politics involved in heathenry, and how do you see it? How do you see this new populism rising up and the right wing, all of that.
Yeah.
The appropriation that some of those movements are making to the heathen cause and to heathen beliefs.
Well, okay. As an American, of course, I know our situation best, and I do not know as much as perhaps I should about how things are going in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated problem.
It is.
But I do see, as heathens, as a heathen, we are in a very interesting situation. I see being a heathen as being in a kind of a microcosm of the situation we have in all of the first world countries. Because, or as an American heathen anyway, because I'm very proud of my American heritage, I'm very proud of my Germanic heritage, and yet I am also absolutely committed to being inclusive. And so I'm trying to walk a rather difficult path where we want to be inclusive, we want to welcome people, we also want to preserve the elements of our heritage. And the first world countries are all having the same problem. At least the liberals are having the problem. Here in the U.S., we have the added, one of the differences between our situation in the U.S. and in Europe is that we have over two centuries of commitment to receiving immigrants and incorporating them, assimilating them, whereas Europe has not had a major immigration going on really since the migrations period. So even Europeans who are committed to being liberal and welcoming don't have a background of how to deal with this. Here in the U.S., we used to have a background on how to deal with this, but our current leadership is trying to get rid of that.
What do you think should be the process? Of course, inclusiveness, but Myself, let me tell you, this is supposed to be a conversation, and let me tell you a bit more about myself, because you probably never heard of me. So I, once again, thank you for accepting my invitation. I'm Portuguese. I don't have, at least that I know of, any direct, well, apart that the first Portuguese king was a direct descendant from Rollo, the real one, at least. Of course. But this is historical, so it's kind of funny. So apart from that, I don't have any direct cultural heritage from any or Norse or heathen tradition.
Well, the Visigoths got around on the Iberian Peninsula.
Yeah, of course, and there are lots of, you know, you have the south. I'm trying to say this in English. The south eastern runes or southwestern runes, Runas do Sudoeste, in Portuguese, which are some runes that were found in the Algarve, actually, and in also in Spain, in the southwestern part of Spain, that we don't know where they came from. We don't know we only know that they are very old, and they are not anything like we have ever seen, and so the historians are a bit puzzled with it, and some of them are coming up with some crazy theories, but the thing is that we do have a history of Vikings invasions and all of that, of course. Well, not probably Vikings as they would not be Vikings at that time, but invasions from Norse people. But apart from that, we have some cultural influence. But apart from that, it's just a matter of identification. So I identify with the and I can relate to the archetypes and to the way that the Norse lore is told, and to the way the Norse mythology came to us, and even the way that we can make this transposition between the nine worlds and our microcosmos, our person, you know, our being. And does this make me less of a heathen, or what do you think about this? This is something that's being discussed here in Europe.
Well, I'm sure, yeah. Well, it gets discussed here too. And we have a lot of our own homegrown people. Heathenry in the United States is increasingly divided into those who think it must absolutely include a physical heredity, and those who feel that, yeah, we are proud of whatever physical connection we may have, but the important thing is that we be called by the gods and or attracted by the values and ethics and ways. So, yeah, I mean, initially, I was working in doing various kinds of magical work in a eclectic pagan path, and I wanted to learn more about Northern European magical ways because I didn't want to misappropriate any of the native traditions that a lot of people were studying at that time. But as I got into practicing heathenry and the group studying the runes, that was the first thing I did. turned into a group to work with the Northern Oracular tradition, and then that sort of turned into a kindred, and people started turning up, and some of them had absolutely no visible connection to the North, but clearly the gods were talking to them. So, you know, if Odin calls somebody, I'm not going to argue.
Yeah. I was looking at your path, and I was finding some similarities with the path that some of us have been making here in Portugal. So we started this rune group in 2012. Then it has evolved in the practicing Seithr. It has been becoming more and more of a kindred. It's not like a formal kindred, but it's funny. We also, some of us have also experienced with Umbanda, and I know that you have had experiences with it as well, right?
Yes, I have. When I got involved with Odin, or when Odin got involved with me, I had the sense that I was being encouraged to continue interacting with other traditions, because perhaps through me he could make connections. I think all of the gods are looking for alliances, and in my experience, the Germanic gods and the African gods get along just fine.
They are very similar in some ways.
In some ways, yes. And also my experience is that the Germanic gods do possess people, that there is somewhat ambiguous, but there is evidence in the lore that suggests that this did happen in an earlier period, earlier than the High Viking Age. But there's bits and pieces of evidence that it happened then. And which I talked about in my book on possessory work. Mm-hmm. And they certainly do today.
Yeah, I'm sure your work with the oracles and with becoming an oracle has been much of an inspiration for many of us. What do you think are the process, or are the processes of becoming that oracle, getting into, you said before, when I got involved with Odin, or when he got involved with me, what is that process of becoming involved with the gods?
Training. Okay, I believe that the ability to alter your state of consciousness and to hear the gods and to be possessed by them is a natural human ability. But as with any other talent, just as some people just naturally have perfect pitch and can sing, whereas others have to do voice training, some people are so open to spiritual experience that it's a problem for them. Whereas others have, in my opinion, all children have this ability, but most children learn to set up barriers and boundaries at an early age. And by the time they're adult, they've lost it. Some don't and often have trouble. But there are, I think what happened with me was that my mother was a very, very strong personality, and I was the only child. And just in self-preservation, I built my barriers up very, very strong, to the point where by the time I was in my 20s, I thought that I was just completely blocked. I was very attracted to magical experience and spiritual experience, but I thought, okay, If I'm in a magical group, I will be the one who watches the door and makes sure the candles don't fall over and catch fire on the curtains. And, you know, that's a useful function.
Yeah,
every group
it is.
Has to have
it is.
Somebody who does that. But it took me many years of just chipping away bit by bit. And that turned out to be useful because then I could kind of break it down and identify the elements and the skills. And I've been able to teach them to other people because of that, both people who also think that they have boundaries and barriers, and people who find it too difficult people who can't turn it off. So the approach that I worked out was that if you practice opening up in very specific ways, then you will gradually get to the point where you only open up when you do these specific things. So you develop your own cues and you condition yourself to respond to them. And that does seem to help both the people who are too open and the people who can't open up at all.
Finding your own triggers, is that it?
Yes, yes, exactly.
So there's not like a formula or something that everybody has to find their own triggers. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, well, there are some that general classes of cues that work for lots of people. For instance, symbols, chants, scent is a good one. Scent, color, symbolism. This is, for instance, where Umbanda has a lot to teach us, or those traditions, because they have elaborately worked out groups of symbols and food and drink and everything.
How did you feel attracted to Umbanda? What attracted
well,
you?
What happened was we had a man in our kindred. He had just passed his oral exam for a doctorate in Scandinavian studies. And at that point they say, okay, now go write your dissertation. And we'd been working with him. He'd been working with Odin. And I thought, gee, we should do something more exciting than just a note from the department head. let's have a ritual, because my response to almost any situation is, let's have a ritual. So I did it. What I had forgotten was that in his Wiccan tradition, he was very good at trance work, but I had the bright idea of doing a ritual based on the plot line of the poem in the Edda Grimnismal, where Odin it comes in disguise to the king's hall and refuses to say who he is. So the king ties him up between two fires and roasts him effectively. And after 17 pages of this, the king's son can't stand this anymore and says, you know, we've got to let him go, and does so. And Odin says, okay, you're going to be king. And then he gives you 17 stanzas of lore that he's apparently been thinking about. So I thought, well, my friend has been studying all of the stuff. He'll have it all at his fingertips. So we'll bring him in. We'll pretend to give him a hard time. Then we'll switch over to being hospitable and put him up in the high seat and ask him lore questions.
Wow.
And I told him, okay, yes, wear your Norse costume. I did not tell him to take the eye patch from his Odin altar and put it on.
Mm-hmm. But,
and I had
but
he
did,
one of
but
the
he
things
did, right?
in one of the things in the poem is that Odin has been set up by Frigga, who warns the king that a dangerous sorcerer is coming around, and you can tell because no dog will attack him. And I had a dog at that time that wouldn't attack anybody. So I thought, okay. So what happened was he came into the house, he put the eye patch on, he saw the dog coming up the stairs wagging his tail, and that was all he knew about anything. And we're all waiting Whoa. In the living room. He comes in, and I'm following the script, you know, what is your name?
I'm getting the chills
and
now.
He looked at me, and he said, Grimnir, in this voice.
Whoa.
And I went, oh, shit. Because I would, you know, I had read about possessory work. I had actually seen this guy possessed in a Wiccan ritual. I had never experienced it. Despite having actually written about it in a novel, I had never had to deal with it. And here we were with Odin in my living room. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
So I quickly got everybody to stop pretending to threaten him and switch over to welcome, welcome, and put him up. And everybody asked their questions, and he answered them all in the first person. And everyone thought, oh, this was what I had intended from the beginning. And then I had to figure out how to get him back.
Oh, yeah. You used Umbanda techniques or something like that?
No, I didn't. But he had a name he used in our oracle group, and he had a pagan name he used in the community. So I, you know, first I got the eye patch off of him, and then I said, please give us back the magical name. See? And then from the magical name to the community name, and from the community name to the legal name.
Yeah.
And that worked.
Oh, okay, great.
And then we got him down and sat him down at the dining table and told him what he'd been doing for the past hour.
Oh.
Because he didn't remember a thing. And shortly after that, another person in our group said, hey, I just went to this ritual from a local group that's doing Umbanda. You should come. And I thought, right, they probably have more experience getting people in and out of possessory trance than anyone else I'm going to meet. I'd better go and find out about this, because here we are. So that was in, I think, around 93. And so I am still working with the Umbanda House. It's not real active right now, but I learned a great deal and learned how to do possessory work myself.
And one of the things that I've been working myself with Umbanda the last 3 or 4 months. It's a very recent thing for me. But one of the things that strikes me the most is the fact that they, first with the Orishas, I don't know how to say this in English. I don't think there's...
Orishas.
Yeah, Orishas.
Yeah, the Orishas.
They don't believe that the Orishas will possess someone, but like not lesser beings, but what they say is that the light from the Orishas would be much too great for the human body. And when I work with possession with the Norse gods, I don't think that applies, right? You could see possessions from Odin himself, from Frigga, from the Norns.
Yes. Well, obviously the totality of the deity is not going to come to a person.
Yeah, it's like
to any human
like a
vessel.
Like a sparkle.
Yeah, but what you do get is very obvious changes in body language and voice, and also in knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I've had many experiences with both the Norse gods and the African gods, Orishas. I know they're not gods.
Okay.
But the Orishas fill the god-shaped slot.
Yeah, they feel.
So they're God equivalent,
let's put it that way. Yeah.
Which, just to digress for a moment, even monotheistic religions on the popular level tend to develop some kind of group of human-shaped beings that people can relate to. So it's saints or it's prophets or teachers or something. Because that's how human minds work. So there's this kind of space in religion for the sort of God equivalents that are not maybe the ultimate supreme divine existence, but they are they appear. It's like in Kabbalah, mm-hmm. where you have Ansof, the ultimate thing, but then it comes down through the tree in the different colors, just as white light has to be broken into subdivisions in order to see anything. So that's, I think, that's where I put the gods. The gods are like the colors. That's how we can relate to things.
Yeah.
So anyway, what comes through a person is obviously going to be limited. And one of the things that I like about the African traditions is they recognize different paths, that even an Orisha is subdivided.
Yeah.
So, you know, Eshu Yangi is not the only Eshu. So you only get the part of that deity that you are able to carry. And so this is where it's useful to have more than one person carrying a particular deity, because then you get more
parts,
aspects.
More aspects, yeah. More subdivisions.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, obviously they are all much too big to be carried completely. But it can be very striking when clearly, and the more sensitive people seeing somebody in this state will see more and more of the god in the person. It can be pretty obvious. There's always the question of it's coming through the filter of the human personality and also the filter of the people who are listening or observing. And this is true in our oracular practice as well. And one of the things that I found interesting when I was reading up on the African traditions is if somebody who is possessed says something, especially if it's questionable, you always get the cowries read. You get a second opinion. So, you know, no matter who you think is talking to you, whether it's the seeress or a god, if they're telling you to go do something drastic, you know, you go get a second opinion.
Yeah, you always have the right to doubt. No?
Yeah, no. I think you have to. You have free will. And it's easy to misinterpret what somebody is saying. And all the traditions that have variations on possessory work will say this. Dion Fortune, the British esoteric writer, talks about mediums channeling. And she says, for an untrained or uneducated medium to try to convey the words of a high power is like Michelangelo trying to sculpt with tin cans. So, yeah. There can be errors in the transmission. So we especially as heathens, we retain our free will and make our own decisions.
Yeah. You were talking about creating arts, and I'm looking at your books and I'm thinking, does any part of the books at any time, was it psychographed? Was it channeled?
Sometimes. The books are kind of written with a sort of consulting partnership, in that with each section, each area that I'm writing about, I'll be asking for inspiration and meditating on it. In terms of more direct speech, that has happened more often in my novels. I was writing in Ravens of Avalon.
Mm-hmm.
That
was exactly the one I was thinking about.
Yes. Well, so the Morrigan is the major goddess in that book, and I'd done some work with the Celtic tradition, but I had not, in fact, worked with the Morrigan, and I had got to a point where I really had no idea what to put. So I finally went, wait a minute, I have a way to deal with this.
I can go directly to the source.
Yes. So my friend that an associate, I said, look, we need to have a session with the Morrigan. Will you rent it for me? So we got some red wine and some raw meat for an, no, it was beer. It wasn't wine. It was beer. She drinks beer. And some raw meat, and called her in, and my friend asked the questions that I had, and she was quite happy to sound off. And so that whole speech, when Boudica has it out with her towards the end there, that all just came straight from her, or at least through my filter. And I was quite surprised that writing that book was a challenge because we have so much historical data on that particular period. There was no way that I could make the Celts win, no matter how much I wanted to. So here they are at the end of it, and you know, she's been defeated. You know, half the people she knows are dead, and. And she's wondering, you know, what was it worth it? You know, what was worth all that we went through? And what's going to happen? You know, and what came through was the gods take a very long view.
Yeah.
and you know, that might have some counsel for some of the things we're going through now. This is all very traumatic, but some of the things that are so painful now may in some future time contribute to a stronger culture.
I think that's the definition of faith.
Yeah. But it doesn't help much when you're sitting there,
yeah,
dying.
When you're in the middle of
homeland
it.
Homeland isn't wrecked.
Yeah, yeah, when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't help much. But
yeah. Thank you so much. You don't have bodies except when you're in us, and then you can escape. But please take the liquor with you.
Yeah, they don't forget
that.
That
was something.
Don't forget the liquor.
When we started working, doing possessory work with the Norse gods, we had to explain to them why they had to take the alcohol with them when they left, and leaving the horse with a hangover is not right, not allowed.
Yeah,
but because, you know, they went, okay, drunk's fine, drunk is part of our culture, what's your problem?
Yeah, that's you know, you make an excellent point there. That explains a lot.
Yeah, yeah, you have, well, possessory work especially has to have rules,
yeah,
which otherwise life can get more exciting than it needs to be.
And it has to be like a, like you said, like a joint venture. It has to be a process of communion and sharing, and not letting an entity just rule over your body. But it has to be like an agreement. Yeah? There has to be an agreement of what you can do, what you cannot do.
Well, yes, yes.
And this is also very interesting. We can get that from Umbanda as well.
Yeah.
They have very strict rules on many things.
Yes, yes, you have to.
But the need to go to Umbanda, it comes from the fact that we don't know that much about old Seth, right? I mean, there are quite there's some lore, but we don't know that much into the process of,
right. Well, in a way, I mean, we actually know more about the Spey rite, which is a subset of Seth, than we do about any other Norse religious practice, because it's the session in Greenland is described in such detail in the saga of Eric the Red, which, you know, complete with what she was wearing. Unfortunately, they didn't give us the words of the song that was sung to put her into trance. But it is clear that she comes to the farmstead. She stays overnight. She has food from the farmstead, which I think means making contact with the local spirits. They make her an elevated seat. She's got a special pillow even to sit on. This is what I mean about the level of detail. And she sits up there, and then she says, So who's going to sing the song? And with my experience in trance work, I went, that's her cue. She's been trained to go into that oracular state when they sing the song. And they everybody kind of looks at each other. And then a young woman says, who is really one of the major characters in the whole saga, which is probably why this whole scene is there. And she says, well, when I was a child, my old nurse knew the song and she taught it to me, but I'm a Christian now and I don't think I should sing it. And the seeress looks at her and says, well, I think you could sing it and be no worse a woman than you are, but why don't you talk to the owner of the farmstead? And we don't know what he said, but I suspect it was something like, you're going to live with these people through a Greenland winter. It would be really a good idea for you to cooperate. So, and in fact, she sings the song and she sings it very well. And the seeress says, you know, oh, the spirits are all around me. You really did a great job. And yes, the famine that you're worried about is going to end. And oh, by the way, I am now going to tell you your future, which she does. And then everybody else asks whatever questions they have.
The high seat ritual?
Yeah. I mean, there it all is. And there are a number of references in other sagas, none of them as complete. But so originally there would be groups that went around from region to region and would set up probably at the home of the biggest farmer. And everybody would come and ask their questions. And these groups would be led by a vova, a senior seeress, but they would have both men and women in them. So we have all, in my group, we've always trained both men and women, and both seem to be able to do it just fine. Yeah.
The place in talking about the high seat ritual, the whole process into getting to trance and to getting the vulva down the path. For instance, here we use Galders. And our own songish intuition of the Galders, but and this is a very egoistic question, because I really wanted to know that song. Do you have any contact with some sort of song that could be close to that song?
Well, in my book, The Way of the Oracle, I know not only included the complete ritual that we use, but the songs with music are in the back. And so what I did, about the time I was getting into all of this, the Scandinavians started publishing or started recording, and the music came out. So the song we use to put the seer into trance goes da 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 da. So it's got this really good rhythm, and it's got these accidentals that the tune doesn't quite go where a European would necessarily expect it to.
Very Celtish as well.
Well, not quite, because the Celts have minor keys, but they don't have all those weird accidentals in there so much. So anyway, there's what I have done in when I wrote the music down was to put. Sorry, I did not turn off the notifications, did I? Just ignore that. And I don't know if I can go do that without breaking our connection. So let's just hope he doesn't do it again. Anyway, so I put down the titles of the folk tunes that I took the music from. So you can probably find a lot of that on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Nice. We're going to definitely explore that. I was looking at the transportation Learning to navigate the inner world, and it's also very you really take the time to explain the whole processes of going into trance. And do you think our society nowadays needs to be in trance more and more? I mean, is that what is missing from our regular day-to-day society?
Well, certainly some kind of meditation practice, whether you call it meditation or prayer or whatever, I think is essential to mental health. And you know that the beginning levels in transportation are things that can be used by anybody and are very useful in daily life, and things like bringing your blood pressure down, just getting calm. So a lot of those practices, putting your boundaries up, taking your boundaries down, focusing, very useful. The later ones are journeying, is if you're trying to make spiritual contact, doing trance journeys is a very useful technique. But that the deeper you get into it, many of those practices are more useful if you then want to go into the special skills like oracle work or possessory work, all of which are, especially possessory work, I think it's much easier to do that safely if you're already accustomed to moving around in your head and changing consciousness.
What I wanted to ask you the most in this entire interview is the following question. Are you ready?
Okay.
When are you coming to Portugal?
You know, I am coming to the conclusion that I'm going to have to do that, because suddenly Portugal's all over the place. I mean, my husband does Second Life online, and he's been running into people from Portugal and talking about how Portugal is doing all these wonderful artistic things. I would love to come to Portugal. Usually I go somewhere when I have to do research for a setting for a book, or if there's some kind of conference. Last year, I went to Germany for a conference that the Troth had set up with the German inclusive heathen organizations. And we had people from all over Europe. We did not have anybody from Portugal. We did have somebody from Spain. There's something called the Asatru Summer Camp. That is in various places.
It was in August.
They were going to do it
in Spain, right? They were going to do it in Spain.
They were going to do it in Galicia last summer. But it didn't seem like a very good idea to do anything in Galicia last summer, and so they ended up doing it in Germany. But I'm hoping that either the European Congress of Earth Religions or the Asatru Summer Camp will have something in the Iberian Peninsula, and then I would have an excuse to come and do something.
So you are more than invited to join us. And the name of our group is the Axis of Ratatoskr. With you know the
okay, you have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Do you have a website?
No, we don't. We don't. I have the podcast itself has a Facebook Facebook page, but the group the group doesn't have. Still,
do send me all of the information on the podcast, so that I can put it on my website.
I will.
And,
I will.
So if people want to listen,
I will. Thank you very much. So.
Thank you. This was fun.
It was lots of fun, and it was really an honor to me. Thank you very much, Diana.
As always, this podcast would not have been possible without the precious help of Pedro Queiroz Martinho with the music and Mariana Rosa Scarpa with the logo. As for me, well, you know me, I'm Marco Diniz Santos. I'll see you next week with an interview with Skald, and this is Weird.